Welcome to the Sex, Money and Rage podcast.
But if we can use breath, if we can use movement, if we know where to put our awareness and we have some ideas of how to kind of give the monkey mind something to do, as the Buddhists say, if we know how to use sound and communication, if we understand touch and really understand how touch impacts us in our bodies, what kind of touch takes us up, brings us down, helps us feel safe, helps us feel grounded, helps us feel pleasure, all these things, then we have all these tools and we don't just solely have to lean on the arousal to take us there.
Welcome back to Sex, Money and Rage. I'm your host, Ellie, and thank you for tuning into another episode. Today's episode is super exciting, full of lots of interesting information around somatic sexology. We're going to cover what is somatic sexology, what does it entail. We talked about different types of arousal levels on a scale of 1 to 10 and how to play in different arenas. We also talked about hormone changes and menstrual cycle changes. So as people, men and women, get older, their hormones change, their sex drive also changes, and how to approach that, how to deal with that, which was super interesting. I really enjoyed this episode because it's information about sex that often isn't covered, I guess, in the mainstream, especially from the somatic perspective, which somatic just means in the body. So a more body-based approach to sex, which is right up my alleyway, as you'll see from the personal stories I share in this episode. So our guest today is Uma Aylett Furman, who is one of Australasia's leading somatic sex educators. She has many years of experience working with individuals, people in relationships, and groups. Uma has innovated somatic sex education through her grounded breaking work in client-centered practice. She's based in Brisbane, Australia, but works internationally, specializing in supporting people to work somatically through sexual issues and concerns. If you're enjoying the show, please hit the subscribe or follow button if you haven't already. Make sure notifications are ticked. It really just helps get the word out about the podcast and also sends you a notification on your phone when new episodes go live. Thank you to everyone who's done it already. You're all legends. And let's jump in and listen to what Uma has to say. Today, I am here with Uma from the Institute of Somatic Sexology, and really interested to have a chat today with you, Uma. But firstly, how are you? How's it going this morning?
I'm doing really well. I'm here in sunny Brisbane, Australia. We're having a beautiful spring day, so I'm enjoying all the flowers opening and the weather warming up, and feels quite joyful in my body today. Thanks for asking.
Nice. That's good. No, I love spring, and we're actually going into rainy season here. So everything hopefully will start turning green soon because it's been really dry and dusty. So yeah, it's cool being in nature. But yeah, maybe we can start off by sort of talking a bit about maybe who you are and what you do, and maybe what is somatic sexology for people who don't know.
Yeah, that's a really great question because not that many people know. So my name is Uma, and I am sometimes I say I'm a somatic sexologist, or sometimes I would say that I am a somatic sex educator, depending who I'm speaking to. What I do is I work with people's sex and sexuality, but I do it in a somatic way. Somatic means, in two words, of the body. So when we look at sex and sexuality, there are lots of different things that come into play for humans. We have a lot of stuff that goes on cognitively for us, and we have a lot of stuff that goes on physically for us. And my specialty is working with the physical aspect of sex and sexuality and arousal and pleasure, and helping people access more pleasure in their bodies. We live in a world that's very much focused on the cognitive and narrative, and we're very intelligent creatures, and we spend a lot of time in our heads, and we spend a lot of our sex lives in our heads too. And that has great benefits, and that is super important. But most people have not spent a lot of time fostering those same aspects in their bodies. So that's my specialty, where I support people, walk beside them, teach them how to access those beautiful sensations that are available to everybody and anybody right here, right now in our magnificent bodies. So in essence, that's what I do. And I'm part of an institute. We are the Institute of Somatic Sexology, and we train practitioners. So people come to us who want to become somatic sexologists or somatic sex educators, and we have different courses that we offer practitioners so they can go and support even more people around the world.
Amazing. I love it. I'm a huge fan of, I guess, more the body-based modalities. I think they're very underrated. And I think it's really cool to be able to pair the somatic kind of framework or methodology with sexuality, like you mentioned. I think that's really cool. And so how did you get into somatic sexology? What sort of drew you in?
I was always a very sexually curious person. And there in my early 20s, I got interested in more esoteric forms of sexuality like Taoism and Tantra and sexual shamanism. I found out that there's all these ancient teachings around sex and sexuality that were very different, almost opposite to what I knew about what sex was and how sex felt for me. So I started studying all of these teachings, and they're very somatic because Tantra, Taoism, lots of different ancient teachings are all a lot about the body and the subtle sensations that we can develop in the body. And so I got into it from that more, esoteric spiritual realm. And then I discovered that there was an emerging new form that was called somatic sexology. I discovered that people started teaching sexology in a somatic way. So sexology has traditionally been a very analytical, very cognitive, profession or body of work. And this is fairly new, the idea of somatic sexology. It's not new because people thought about it 5,000, 6,000 years ago already, but they just called it something else. And so I love the old teachings. I think they have a lot in there for us, but they're not always that applicable to modern life and to modern people. And they're not always that applicable if you perhaps are not seeking a spiritual experience, or perhaps are sitting a little bit outside the old boxes of masculine and feminine and men and women, or perhaps if you're not that into idea of energy and energy flow and all those woo-woo things that some people really resonate with and other people just want nothing to do with. And so somatic sexology kind of came out of a lot of somatic methods that started developing in the 60s, 70s and 80s around the world. A lot of somatic psychotherapy that came out, and also a lot of out of a lot of methods around movement, around breathing, around. So we look at, okay, what are these elements that help our body thrive? What are these elements that help our body feel more and access more sensation? And how can we harness those elements when we look at sexuality?
Amazing.
And so that's been my journey around it. And I do a bit of everything now. I love the spiritual aspect of sexuality. I still practice Tantra. I still teach it. I still study those more esoteric realms. But what I teach and what I pass on is more applicable and more modern and more relevant, I feel anyway.
Yeah, that's really cool. I think that's super interesting, what you said about it being previously being quite analytical and now kind of bringing in that physical element, the somatic element, you know, playing with sensations and I guess reconnecting the body and the mind because they are very closely interlinked. And so do you find that by working with the body in this somatic sexology that helps the brain or the mind, or how do you see that relationship?
Well, we're kind of separating them artificially, really. The mind and the body are one and the same. Like we have this artificial separation to talk about it.
Yeah.
But absolutely, when you learn things through your body, you're changing your neurology in your brain. When you learn new things in your brain, cognitive, you're also changing neurology. And so particularly when it comes to sexuality, most people on the planet are really, really good at thinking of sex, at fantasizing about sex, at watching sex. And we call that the psychogenic arousal pathway. I think of something, it turns me on. That's called psychogenic arousal. We're not that great at the somatic pathway of arousal. And so often what happens is sex is very much in the brain, but then it's felt very little in the body because there are all these habits and patterns that have been created over the years that are actually blocking sensation rather than helping us feel more. And ideally, to have really great sex, we want both of those switched on. We want to understand our psychogenic arousal and our fantasies and desires and what turns us on and who turns us on and play with it and explore it. But we want to also feel it in our bodies in the best possible, in the most possible way we can. And we can. And so when someone comes to me and says, oh, I can think about sex and that turns me on a lot, and if I try not to think about sex, I end up thinking about a whole bunch of other random stuff and that completely turns me off, I know, okay, the somatic element has not been switched on. So what we have to do, at least in the beginning, is put the psychogenic bit aside and develop the somatic aspect, so then eventually a person has choice. A person can either just be in the feeling or just be in the thinking, or have them both coming together, like weave them together and at any shape, way or form that they want to. But most people that I come across are lacking of that choice. A lot of people don't even know that there is a choice, actually. I didn't know there was a choice before I came into this world.
That makes sense. I think, I didn't realize it's something I talked to a friend about is, you know, it's all well and good to look back and be like, oh, now I know what it means to be in my body. But before you've had that experience of feeling what it feels like to be in your body, it's very hard to conceptualize. I've found, like, how, say someone came to you and they're like, it sounds like a lot of people, they're in their head, they're, you know, thinking and they're not in their body. What's sort of the process to get them to drop into their body? How do you sort of get them to start focusing on sensations and things to bring that sexual pleasure on board even more?
we look at the five somatic pillars or somatic tools. We've got breath, movement, placement of awareness. What are you doing with your mind? We've got sound and touch. So we have those five elements. The more elements we incorporate and the more elements we have going in one time, the more full our experience in our body will be. And so each person is a little bit different because they will have things that resonate with them that feel really good when they do it and other things that are a bit more tricky for them. So I look at these five elements with a person and will say, okay, where should we begin? Where's a good place to start? Do we want, and it's always a collaborative effort because every person is so unique and it's not for me to decide what's good for them. It's for the person that comes to me to understand the possibilities and say, that's what I want, or this is what I want. And when we decide which element we're going to start with and start exploring it. So let's say you say to me, oh, I'm really interested in breath. I think that would be a good way for me to start connecting with our body. So we try lots of different things around breath, different types of breath that create different sensations in your body. And through this collaborative effort, we figure out what works for you. So I just throw a whole lot of different ideas at people and they throw them back at me. And sometimes they say, yeah, that one's great. Or I hate that one. That's shit. So we throw it out. Or this one's okay, yeah, but it's not sitting quite right. And so we tailor it to whatever works for that person. And that changes with time as well. But we need to get in somehow. Mm-hmm. And so we find that I try and find the easiest way to get in. And so we say, okay, let's just add those two or three breaths that you've learned to all the sex you're having right now. Don't change anything else. How you're masturbating, how you're having sex with your partner, just add this breath and let's see what happens. It's a bit of a experiment, right? And then they'll come back to me and say, well, this is what happened and that's what happened. And then we see what's been working and what's been not working, meaning I tried this breath, I got so distracted, I couldn't feel anything. It's like, okay, maybe that's not quite the way, or maybe we need to practice it a bit more on its own before we integrate it in to sex. And then we also look at how we integrate it in as well, mm-hmm. because when we're having sex, either with ourselves or with another person, a lot of the times we're really invested in that. We want to have a good time. We want the other person to have a good time. It's not always that easy to try new things, especially things that you feel a bit clunky around. Mm-hmm. There's the new things of, oh, let's try this new sexual position, or I've got this new toy. But when it comes to changing how our bodies react in the moment, when we're in a state of arousal, it's not so easy. Our sexual habits are really probably some of our strongest habits that we have. And so we also need to work at, okay, let's say we worked out that doing these three breaths helps you really feel really open and really relaxed, and you think it's a really good idea to start integrating into your sex life. How do we integrate it? How do we bring it in? And again, that's individual for each person. How do we titrate in that eventually it feels kind of natural and flows.
Mm.
And that's a hard thing to do on your own. It's really useful to have someone walking beside you that you can say, that you can come back and feedback with. And that's where practitioners are really important. There's a lot of information that you can get online. There are amazing books. We are in an unprecedented time of information. And there's some incredible things out there, but often people try to do something. It sounds like a good idea. They try it, but they don't necessarily know exactly how to titrate it or how to transition it. And that's when working with a practitioner can be so important.
Do you find that, like, so people who are in, I guess, relationships, if one partner is sort of on board with it and practicing it, does the other partner need to be, or is it something that people can do on their own, or how does it all that work?
It can be either. So when we think of our sexuality, there's the sexuality that we have with ourselves, and then there's how we relate to others. What you have with yourself is not impacted by whether your partner is into changing anything or not. And this, and self-practice for me is the foundation of sex and sexuality. And I wish there was more attention to it. I wish they were teaching young people how to have amazing self-practice sessions and how to activate their bodies. Because once you have that foundation in your own body, you're already relating differently to someone else, whether they're doing something else or not. Instead of just projecting, oh, they're not doing what I want, how about learning what it is that you want? How about getting really great at accessing all the pleasure in your body? How about getting really great at articulating what it is that works for you? All of those things that we can really learn on us on our own, whether our partners are into changing anything in their relating or not. By you changing yourself, it will impact their relationship, their relating anyway. And yes, when partners are interested, then absolutely we can go from there, because there are lots of things that you can kind of harness your partner to do. A lot of practices that you can do with a partner together, and that creates a whole very unique experience. But just because a partner is not interested doesn't mean that you should avoid doing this work.
For sure, for sure. I remember when I didn't even know somatic sexology was a thing. I kind of ended up doing it, I guess, by accident. I very much got into somatics maybe 4 years ago. I started seeing a somatic counselor, and then I started getting into doing, I guess, regular somatic exercises sort of day to day about 3 years ago. And it was really interesting. I can't remember what made me think to do it, but I started to go, oh, like, I wonder what happens if I pair these techniques of, you know, feeling the ground or paying attention, like you said, to different sensations or movement, bringing that awareness in of the physical body. What if I brought that into the sexual realm? And it was like, it blew my mind. Like, it was like having sex for the first time. It's like, oh my God, like how?
Right?
Yeah. It's like, what was I doing before? You know? So like, I think, totally, like, there's so much.
Well done for integrating it.
Thanks. Yeah. It's been a lot of fun. I think, like, super empowering as well, and bringing you into the present moment as well, but also just like you said, it heightens the sensations in the body. It's like improved my relationship with myself and with other people as well. I think that was a really cool point you made about, you know, like, as you become more embodied or more present in your physical body, you know, in the sexual realm, like, you're going to change the way you relate to people and your partner and whoever, and probably without even realizing it, you know, you'll be more able to speak up and say, oh, can you do this, or can we do that? Or yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, it inevitably changes the relationship for the better. And or sometimes it changes the relationship when you realize you're in the wrong relationship, because your partner can't meet your needs.
Sure.
That can be sad but also useful. But it certainly does. And I found over the years that by me being open and embodied and alive, it encouraged my partners to do the same, because we all say, oh, I want what she's having.
Yeah.
You know, your partner can say, oh my God, she's having such a great time. I want to do that too. So it's that kind of curiosity that sparks other people's willingness to explore and to learn and to see different things. But we can't it's not our job to change our partners. It's our job to change ourselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And do you find, I mean, I assume this would be pretty common, but for some people, like, I guess there's, for a lot of people, there's probably a reason they're not in their body, whether it's that they don't feel safe or they're uncomfortable, or maybe just that they don't know how to, being that we live in a very mental society. But do you find, I guess, people have, I guess, triggers or things that come up from that they're dealing with when they're kind of going through these practices where they maybe have to, you know, in the middle of sex, say like, let's take a pause. Like, I can't keep going at the moment. Like, I just need a 5-minute break or whatever. Like, do you find that people sort of have those issues come up?
They can. And again, it depends how much trauma you're carrying. I think it can be, even if, so when you start connecting with what's happening in your body, regardless of whether it's through sex or just through other somatic practices that are non-sexual, you feel more. And you feel more, you can feel more pleasure, but you also feel all sorts of emotions that are sitting in the body. You can have all of a sudden a flow of sadness or a flow of anger or a flow of joy. I don't know, did that happen to you when you first started doing the work?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was interesting. It sort of became like a vessel for like processing or releasing emotion. Like, weirdly enough, it was like I'd have this rage come up and then I was able to sort of channel the rage and express it through a sexual practice, which, like, again, was really, really cool. Because I guess from like the nervous system angle, when you're, you know, in a sexual situation, whether on your own or with someone else or other people, you're in a heightened, more of a sympathetic state. So, you know, rage and grief and these other emotions often come out when you're in a sympathetic state. So, like, it made a lot of sense and it was really helpful to be able to channel that through an activity and release it in that way. But yeah, for sure. Like, there were times when I had to say to someone, like, look, I can't keep going. Like, I have to stop.
Yeah.
And, you know, some partners obviously are more understanding than others, but, you know, most people are actually really good, thankfully.
Absolutely.
I think for me, it was like, it's like saying no is like, it felt like such a huge thing to do, but it was so important to be able to learn to do that, regardless of the outcome. But yeah,
well done.
Totally had that experience.
Yeah. So it is, it's that kind of sense of overwhelm or emotions moving through. And in the beginning, it can be quite disorientating. And after a while you get used to it and you understand it and you also know what's going on. And so part of the work is preparing a person to say, oh, this might happen. And when that happens, what are we going to do? Like you, we're going to have a pause.
Have
you don't
plan.
Have to push through right. it. Or and so mm-hmm. what I teach people is self-regulation. And so amongst other things. So when those big emotions come up or when the rage come up, you have a choice. Okay, do I want to run with it and let it flow out? Or do I want to take myself from sympathetic down, back down to parasympathetic and calm my nervous system down? Because we have a choice.
Yeah. Totally.
And so what do I want to do at any given moment? So when people feel, not just know that they have a choice, but feel in their body and explore that in their body and go, oh yeah, I can change direction. Look, I just changed direction. Oh my God. Oh, I just did that. I changed my breath. I changed my touch. I asked that person to stop and I changed direction. That's empowerment. And so the more empowered you feel, the more you can play with these things. The more brave you are to go, oh, yeah, let's go down that road. And because I know I have choice. I know, and the other choice as well is through communication, which is another piece that's really important to teach people around. How do we say no easily before we've crossed our boundaries? How do we feel the no or the pause or the I need to change direction and are able to communicate it in the moment while we're at a heightened state? Rather than think of it, go past all of our boundaries and consents and eventually said, well, when we're really triggered. And again, that's the work that you do in sessions that then helps you do that in real life.
In practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I also think that sensation, particularly arousal, can get sometimes overwhelming. When you feel a lot, it's sometimes like it can be really overwhelming. If it's even if it's just that pleasure and arousal and sensation. And for some of us, that overwhelm shuts us down. It's a defense mechanism of the body. Oh, this feels like too much. Oh, I'm done. I'm checking out. I'm in my head, or I got to walk away. And it's a little bit, I think of it a little bit like fitness. You know, if you went into a CrossFit class for advanced people and you've got no fitness, you'll last 5 minutes and just go, I can't. Your body will literally shut down. It's a little bit like that with pleasure and arousal. If it's too much too soon, you just can't, your system can't handle it. And so this is, again, it's that piece of, okay, we'll just take this arousal slowly and have a little bit at a time and then relax the body and then have a little bit more and teach the nervous system how to hold that first, that it can hold, and how to hold this, all of that sensation, all of that arousal without getting too overwhelmed or shutting down.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like you're sort of building this capacity, this, like, I can handle this a little bit. Okay. Let's do a little bit more next time. And sort of, and then I guess that builds self-trust as well, because, you know, you're getting this data points of, oh, I can handle this and I can do this. And I, you know, maybe I didn't say no that time, but I saw it or I noticed it and I pulled back, or like, you know, like kind of seeing these little micro shifts happening can definitely like build a lot of self-trust for sure.
Yeah, completely. And there are two, I'm being very binary here and I'm very much generalizing. But what I've seen, so it's that there are the one of us, the intensity junkies of us, where the overwhelm is just so exciting. I'm one of those.
Let's get to the
overwhelm.
Oh my
God, I can't even think. Wow, let's just do more of that. And that the learning for an intensity junkie is not how to dive right in, but how to slow down and feel those more subtle, nuanced sensations and pleasures. What is it like to just be a little bit aroused and hang out there? What is it like to be relaxed and aroused and hang out there? What happens when you just hang out there for a really long period of time? And so there's a whole bunch of learning around slowing down. And then for the other people, it is about learning to hold that arousal, because that intensity is too much and it shuts you down. And then you learn, okay, I can handle this. I can do a little bit more and a little bit more. So everybody's quite unique, and it's important to, you know, sometimes you listen to things and you read things and it's written by someone, let's say, that really loved that intensity, and you're trying it and it's way too much for you, and you're thinking, oh, what's wrong with me? How come I'm not enjoying it? Everybody else is saying it's such a great thing. No, it's just that your nervous system is structured a little bit differently to their nervous system, and you need to approach it in a different way. You're not broken. There's nothing wrong. It's just something for everyone, but not the one thing that works for all of us.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to make. That kind of difference between, you're like, some people are going to be more, yeah, like go, 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 let's, you know, do all these things and like excitement. And then other people are going to kind of be that quieter. And so it's kind of, yeah, like kind of pulling yourself into the opposite of what you're used to, and just exploring things, which sometimes can be quite uncomfortable. Like I know for me, not even in a sexual sense, but just in a general sense, like I'm very much, you know, always doing something, you know, always on the go, like I'm very passionate, motivated, you know, which traditionally people go, that's really good. But then you get burnt out and there's all these other things that can happen. So it's, for me, it's been like a really good practice to learn to slow down. I had never thought about it in a sexual context. So I think that's really interesting to reflect on. But it's, I think for a lot of people, it's learning how to slow down, learning how to be present. And I think, I guess for a lot of people, you know, especially myself, the thing that maybe prevents people from slowing down often it is that mind, is those racing thoughts and not wanting to be with that, because sometimes it's just not enjoyable listening to all that stuff going in the head. But yeah.
Absolutely. And it takes, so if we think of arousal, and I'm speaking specifically around about sexual arousal, because there are lots of different types of arousal that we can experience. And if you have a tendency to be in your head, whether it's through in sexual fantasy or just have random thoughts coming in at all sorts of inappropriate moments, at a certain level of arousal, we can quieten our mind down. The arousal itself can have an impact on our mind and help it slow down a little bit. But it's quite a high level of arousal. Like if we think of 0 to 10, with 10 being an orgasm, we're probably talking about the 7, 8, and 9. And so in an attempt to quieten the mind, some people race towards that high arousal because it is much harder to stay present in those low levels arousal in the beginning until you learn how to do it. And this is why we need to, and this is why using the body is so important, because if I just count on my arousal, if I have no other skills, then yeah, I got to kind of hang out in those high numbers, and I can only hang out there for so long, really. Not that many people can hang out there for a really long amount of time. And I'm missing out on all of that pleasure that happens before. So much of that pleasure that happens before. Engorgement and pleasure saturation and being really expansive. All sorts of things happen before that we miss out on if we skip those numbers. And so if we can use breath, if we can use movement, if we know where to put our awareness and we have some ideas of how to kind of give the monkey mind something to do, as the Buddhists say, if we know how to use sound and communication, if we understand touch and really understand how touch impacts us in our bodies, what kind of touch takes us up, brings us down, helps us feel safe, helps us feel grounded, helps us feel pleasure, all these things, then we have all these tools and we don't just solely have to lean on the arousal to take us there.
I think, yeah, that's a really cool point, especially like I think you mentioned before, you know, like with sex toys and different things, it's sort of easy to kind of use these things. But, you know, one idea I had just then is like, what if you just stripped all of that away and you just had like your hands, for instance, or, you know, like you just had, like you said, physical touch, you know, how would that change your experience? How would that change how you felt physically? Or, you know, and then it's sort of, I remember doing I think it was a Tantra workshop a few years ago. And, you know, one of the exercises they got us to do was just different forms of touch. So you have like, you know, just regular touch. Then you had, I think it was like fire, was where you're like kind of clamping the person's arms. You know, you could use your nails, like you could sort of hover, like there's all these different forms of touch that you can play with. And so it's almost like bringing that curiosity into it and experimentation to go, like you said, you know, what does my body like? Cause it, like you said, it's going to be different for everyone, and figuring out what feels good. And then obviously then being able to communicate that to a partner. Yeah, it's really cool.
And also understanding that that changes constantly.
Yeah.
That what feels good, what felt good yesterday is not the same as what's going to feel good today. And for people who ovulate, the hormonal configuration and fluctuating a hormonal configuration changes the relationship with touch. So it's sometimes when you have more estrogen in your body, you'll want a particular, you'll have an extra sensitivity, and that will be different for different people, what that means. And then other times you have less estrogen, your sensitivity will change again and you'd want something else. And so that is constant, and that's changing. And that's just one aspect. This is a hormonal aspect. And then when you're going through perimenopause and menopause, where the hormones are changing again, here's another mystery. Okay, all of those things that worked for me before don't feel the same now. What does? What will? And so many people give up around that stage and say, oh, well, it's not working for me anymore, so I must not be a sexual being anymore.
Right.
It's like, no, just because the thing that you figured out when you were 16 is not working for you at 60 doesn't mean you're not a sexual being. It just means your body's changed and we've got to figure out what it wants and what it needs. And I get a lot of people who come to me at a time of change in their lives, after birth, after different medical procedures, around menopause, perimenopause, menopause, if you're a penis owner as well, you know, hormones change. They don't fluctuate through the day as much, but around 50s and 60s, your testosterone goes down. So again, a life change, and people are kind of coming and saying, it's not working anymore, I'm broken.
Yeah.
And so we have to figure out, okay, no, you're not broken. You're just different.
Mm-hmm.
And are you doing anything differently? No, I'm still doing the same thing, but it's not working. Okay, let's figure out. By trying different types of touch, by trying to calm your mind down, by helping you focus, what can work for you now? And if you have that mindset from your age, Ellie, if you start having that mindset of, oh, I'll just try different things and I'll constantly be curious about it and explore, then you won't have a crisis. It will just naturally, you know, evolve. You'll just, you're speaking, you're listening to your body. And so you'll just be in tune around what it needs at any given time.
Mm-hmm. And I think like how empowering that is for people to realize, like, you know, you're not broken. Like you said, you just need to reconfigure what feels good for you and go back into your body and test things and just play around. Yeah, I think that's really cool. And especially what you said about the hormonal changes as well, especially different times of the menstrual cycle for women. My friend and I actually talk about this is like, you know, our sex drive really can change depending on where we are in our cycle. And, you know, it's like very consistent. I tracked it one time and it's just blows my mind just how like even the touch could change, you know, and the sensations that you desire all just come down to hormones largely, which is so interesting. Yeah.
I know. We're slaves to our hormones.
Yeah. But then you can play into it and, you know, if you know kind of what's going on or if you have a partner, you can sort of play into that and go, okay, like this is, let's try this thing around this time. And it's, yeah, it becomes very much like a game, which is.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I love that you tracked it. And I think keeping a diary around touch and drive, because there's the sexual drive, but there's what kind of touch do I enjoy beyond sex, beyond getting off, so to speak, through the month, and tracking it for a few months and having that data and having your partner know that data as well.
Totally.
And so they know where you're at. I think it's just, it's so precious and it's just lovely. And you build on that, right? You can get then curious, go, oh, I know I like that, so maybe we can add this or add that and let's just see what happens. And there isn't that mystery that goes on in, especially in relationships, but also in solo relationships around, oh, I don't know. I don't know what she wants. I don't know what he wants, what they want. I'm just going to guess my way around and hope something sticks.
Yeah. I think too, like, it takes a lot of pressure off because it's like, you know, something might not be working, like you mentioned, and people can get really stressed out or like, oh, my partner, I did this last time and now they're not enjoying it this time. Like, am I doing something wrong? And again, we go back into our heads and all the stories. So by understanding like the hormonal cycles, like you said, touch and sex drive, you know, it really takes the stress out of it or the shame of I'm not doing something right. And it's like, oh, maybe it's just a different part of the month and the hormone system is just different.
Exactly. You know? Like, and I think you raised a really good point around this idea, which is a really current kind of modern idea that we have, that someone else is responsible for our pleasure. I am responsible for your pleasure. So if I couldn't give you pleasure, I give you this pleasure, and if I couldn't do it, I did a bad job, I'm unworthy. I'm not a good enough person. I'm not a attractive enough person. You must not love me. You name it. You know, all of these projections that we have on each other, which can be so destructive, because nobody should be in charge of anybody else's pleasure. We should all be in charge of our own pleasure and ask other people to help out. Absolutely. Yes, please.
But it's not need an extra pair of hands over here.
It's not your job to just know. And it's not your job to give me a pleasure or to give me an orgasm. And if you didn't do your job right, I'm quoting, then that makes you a really bad person. That's just so destructive. And it's destructive for both people because...
Yeah, disempowering.
Right? If one person takes it on as doing a bad job, then the other person feels guilty because innately they know it's not really their job.
Their job.
And that can create a lot of pressure in relationships, especially when something is not, let's say, functioning the way it's meant to function. Let's say someone has an issue with engorgement. They're not getting engorged enough. And then the other person is taking it on as, oh, that was my job to get you engorged, and now you're not getting engorged enough, so I'm doing a really bad job. And the person that's not getting engorged enough is thinking, oh, my God, I don't want them to feel bad. I need to get engorged. And then they put all this pressure on themselves, which is actually making it worse, not better.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I totally agree that, you know, pleasure is everybody's individual responsibility. And I think, like you mentioned, you know, as soon as we put that onto someone else, it's like you're just adding stress to yourself and the other person, which, like you said, is just going to have the complete opposite effect of what you're seeking. So, yeah, it makes total sense. And so I guess what are some of the common problems that people say would come to see a somatic sexologist about? Like, is it kind of boundaries, consent, communication, or is it more kind of sexual dysfunction? What are some of the problems that people, the common ones that people face? Yeah.
So I don't like calling it dysfunction, because I think it's very medicalized and it's a very negative way of looking at these things. I like calling them issues and concerns because we have this narrow idea of what is function. Sure. Sexual function is this very narrow thing of an erect penis inside a wet vagina, going towards orgasm in a very kind of normative way. It's just so limiting. And if we think of function in a wider way, lots of things can be sex. You know, because if a penis doesn't get erect, does that mean it's dysfunctioning? Like, it's just not getting erect. It doesn't mean it's not there, and now you can't play with it, and that the penis owner can't have pleasure.
Sure.
If a clitoris can't reach a peak orgasm, a clitoral orgasm or a peak experience, does that mean it's not, it's incapable of having a really nice time? And the owner of the clitoris is not able to act to enjoy a sexual interaction. And so I like to kind of take the dysfunction away. But going back to your question, about half of the people that come to see me are coming with issues and concerns. And the other half of the people are not coming because there's anything wrong. They're coming because they want to learn more. They're curious. They're saying, no, everything's fine, but I know there's more. It's a bit like what you did with when you brought all of your somatic tools into sexuality. There wasn't any, I'm not hearing there was anything wrong. You would just thought, oh, what if I just did that? It might be even better. And so that's a lot of fun to work with when people are kind of saying, yeah, everything's great, but I want it to be even better.
Yeah.
And then the other half of the people that come to see me are coming with, there's a huge variety of issues and concerns. So everything from issues around engorgement, whether it's penises getting erect, vulvas getting sufficiently engorged, issues around orgasm, I ejaculate too quickly or I can't ejaculate at all, or people with vulvas who have issues orgasming, they can't reach that peak experience, or lack of sensation, I'm not feeling much in my genitals or any other erogenous zones, pain, sometimes pains with intercourse, internal pain often with people with vaginas. These are like the more localized issues, and then you have more generalized issues around boundaries and consent. I want to have better boundaries. I want to be able to communicate what it is that I want, or I don't actually know what it is that I want. I want to figure it out so I can communicate it to someone else. Social anxiety is a really big thing. And so we know a lot of people talk about having social anxiety. It's a really common thing that people experience, and that often translates to the bedroom. If you're anxious in a room full of people, it's likely you might be anxious with a new partner. And it's so anxious, in fact, that you might not even try going with someone, because just the thought of it is anxiety producing for you. And so how do we, working with that, gaining more confidence around being with another person, getting confidence in your body. And often if we're anxious, in our minds, it translates to our body in some way. Yeah.
So with sort of people who have these, I guess, concerns and issues, social anxiety, do you find that the more they learn to come into their body through, like you said, the breath, the movement, awareness, sound and touch, do you find a lot of these issues kind of self-correct, or what's the process look like for some of these people?
Ah, that's like my favorite thing to do, is to figure out the process. I like to think of it, it's a little bit like detective work, where I imagine that I'm a fly on the wall. There's a situation happening and I'm fly on the wall, and I'm trying to figure out what is happening for that person that created that situation. And what are some of the things that their body is unconsciously doing to support that situation that we need to unwind and take back?
Mm-hmm.
And so, like you said in the beginning about when you first learned about somatic practices. There's just all these things that you didn't know you didn't know. And once you knew them, your body experienced lots of different things. And so we carry habits in our bodies that from a very, very young age, where we learn to dumb down our breath, we learn to carry a lot of tension in our body, we learn to shut ourselves kind of in by closing our shoulders down, we learn to say nothing and not communicate because we don't want to create a fuss, or maybe we were told off or something of that sort. And all of those things that we're unconsciously doing exacerbate that particular the issue that we're working on, the concern that we're working on. So I want to know, I want to kind of imagine that I'm in the room and I want to see what's happening to that person. And then we start working on going, all right, so let's get you really comfortable with your breath. Let's start working on your posture. Let's work on ways that once your mind starts kicking in with anxiety, how do we regulate? How do we down-regulate your anxiety, sympathetic functioning? How do we get you into parasympathetic functioning? When do we need to do it before it's too late and you're just gone, you're completely gone and it's too hard to bring it back? And so we figure all of those things out and we start just practicing those elements outside of any situation. Just get really good with these particular tools that you then have in your toolbox, and then we start looking at, all right, when are we pulling these tools out and when do we start using them and when do they work and when is it too late for them and they're not working anymore? So it's a process, and part of working with a somatic sexologist is that you don't just go for sessions. You have a session, you learn skills, you go home and practice. The more you practice, the faster your transformation is going to be. There's no doubt to that. You put in the time. It's not what happens in session. It's everything that happens between sessions that creates the difference. And then we kind of approach these situations and we look at, okay, if we think of social anxiety, for example, and we think, I try to even put my profile on a dating site, and just thinking about putting that my profile on a dating site is shutting, you know, I'm getting completely anxious about it. And so, okay, how about we take some time to down-regulate the body before we approach the idea of going and going to the dating site? And how about we just put the dating site on without you needing to put a profile on, just so you can have a look at it? And then when you start feeling your anxiety, what tools do we need to bring to regulate that anxiety? Or I'm just about to go on a date. I'm so excited, which is great, but now I'm actually completely anxious and I can't get through with my date. What do we need to do to kind of calm the body down enough so you still feel excited but not petrified?
Yeah. No, I think that's
on a nutshell.
Yeah.
It works like that for lots of different things. And sometimes we get really gritty around, what is actually happening in the bedroom? What is actually happening when you're having intercourse? Because sometimes the issue is there. And sometimes the issues are more global around dating and relating and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, is just the versatility of, I guess, the somatic practices, because, you know, it's these foundational things you can do like in the day to day, you know, learning how to create that safety in your body, in the environment, you know, like you mentioned, social anxiety being a really common thing that obviously is not just limited to the bedroom. It's probably, you know, most of the person's life, you know, in different settings. And so by working on it, like with those different exercises sort of bit by bit throughout the day, it sort of all kind of overlaps and translates throughout all the different areas, which is really cool. And so I guess for people who want to, I guess, learn more about maybe studying somatic sexology or want sessions, I know you've got two courses coming up. Did you want to sort of chat a bit about those and what's included?
Sure, I'd love to. So the Institute teaches different trainings. One training that we have been teaching for a really long time is the Certificate in Sexological Bodywork, which is the brainchild of Dr. Joseph Kramer, who lives in San Francisco, and his certificate is taught all over the world. We're the people who teach it in Australia, and this is for people who are wanting to be somatic sex educators and body workers. So this certificate teaches you not just how to be an educator, but how to work with people's bodies, how to teach your clients about touch, how to help people understand their anatomy, their physiology, their arousal patterns. We run that every year. We have a current training already going. And then we have a training that is starting in October, which is our first training of its kind, and it's the Certificate in Somatic Sex Coaching. And so what we realized teaching sexological body work, because it's a body work modality, is that a lot of people are not comfortable receiving touch from practitioners. Some are really appreciating it, and a lot of people really need it, but a lot of people are at an entry level that's kind of a little bit before that. They're not comfortable with a practitioner putting their hands on them to do the work, as important as it is. And so we developed the Certificate in Somatic Sex Coaching, which is a non-touch modality for practitioners who want to work with clients in a slightly different way. It covers different aspects of sex and sexuality. We look at different aspects of relating, different aspects of self-practices. How do you coach someone in a somatic way? So how do we take the coaching from cognitive, from solely cognitive to somatic? How do you teach someone how to feel something in their bodies? So that's starting in October, and I'm very excited about it because we've just finished developing it, and it's the first time we're teaching it. So it's like our little baby that we are birthing.
Yeah.
And so anybody who's interested, all you got to do is contact the Institute, and we will send you all the materials and talk to you about it.
Amazing. And so I guess one question I had was, I don't know myself, but what I guess happens in a somatic sexology session for, say, you mentioned, you know, there's touch and different things, and then maybe somatic coaching is more the sort of hands off, sort of more getting people to sort of feel into their body or feel embodied. Like what happens sort of in a standard somatic sexology session?
Lots of things can happen in a somatic sexology session. And again, depending on the scope of the practitioner and on what works for the client. And so I work with people on a wide scope, and some people come to me and they're not ready for any touch to happen for them. And so we work somatically, but without any touch, and some people are comfortable with touch. What kind of touch changes from a person to person, but essentially we start by checking in, where we look at their intention for the session, and then from their intention we work out what we call a learning objective. Why are you here for? What do you like? Do you want to learn? And through that learning objective, we work out what we call an educational contract. So you might have a learning objective around, I want to learn how to access more pleasure in my body. And that's a wonderful learning objective. And then we talk about it a little bit because I want to see, okay, what are you currently doing that's working for you? And where are the places where you can learn more about? We work out a learning objectives and from there an educational contract. And so I suggest a few different things, possibilities for the sessions. Maybe we do a full body mapping where we literally map your body for different types of touch. Or maybe we learn about different types of movement that could help you access more pleasure in your body. So I give some ideas to the client. The client then chooses. They decide what feels right for them. They might say, I don't like any of your ideas, and then I'll come up with some more ideas. Or they might have a really clear thing, oh yeah, I really want to do this or I want to do that. And then we work out, part of the educational contract is that we work out what that would look like. So if we're doing a full mapping session, what would that look like? Are we going to touch everywhere in the body or some places on the body? Where do we touch? Where don't we touch? Are you clothed? How many layers of clothing are you having on? Are you covered? Like all of those pieces are not really up to me. They're completely up to the client. And I have no investment in what that looks like. So it's all about empowering their client to make their own choices around what works for them and what feels right for them in the moment. Because often people come with big ideas, and once you're in the moment, they're like, "Oh, actually, I don't want that. That doesn't seem relevant anymore." And so it's really getting into the nitty gritty, having really clear agreements what will happen during our time of doing. And then we decide how long that's going to be for as well. We'll do this for half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, whatever whatever's applicable, whatever the client also feels is a useful time for them. We go ahead and do the work. Once that's finished, we have a little feedback session. We talk about what was that like, what worked, what didn't work, what they learned, what they're taking away, and what they're going to do at home. So ideally, everything I teach a person or we work on in session, there is a version of that they take home to practice. So the last bit of the session is us figuring out what is that version, what that looks like, how often you're going to practice it, and that's where sometimes some people find it really useful, that sense of accountability, you know, where we might work out an accountability system. Are you going to send me an email after your practice, or are you just committing to doing it? You know, whatever works for each person. And then we close the session. They go home. They do their practice. They don't do the practice, which is also part of the learning, because sometimes coming back and saying, I couldn't practice. I had a complete block. It's like, great, let's figure that out. Let's figure out what this block is all about. And that's the work. So ideally, you know, this is not like, you can only do so much in a one-off session. This is all about continuous, a body of work that you do with a practitioner over a period of time. And see your practitioner regularly, whatever regularly means to you. Some people want to come once a week, others once a month, some every 6 months, and that's very individual. So that's what a session looks like. And then what happens at each session is really relevant to that particular time in that particular session and is always negotiated.
Yeah, it sounds like, yeah, really interesting and empowering, I think, for, you know, people to come in and learn to practice things like, yeah, like what feels good, these different exercises, sexually, the consent, the boundaries, even, you know, saying no, or, you know, just working through whatever it is they want to work through and in a controlled environment, you know, because often if it's with a partner or someone you're having a one night stand with, probably it's not going to be as, you know, necessarily productive as sort of seeing a professional who can sit there and process, okay, let's stop and pause and dialogue here. You know, I think that it's, yeah, really empowering and cool to have that container for people to explore these different things sexually. Yeah.
I think it's very important and very rare. We don't really have opportunities in our lives in modern society to have those environments where we call it practice versus concerto. So let's say a concerto is I want to have great sex with my partner or with myself. And this is when, you know, concerto is when you want things to work really well for you and you invested in it. And practice is when we can put some of our attraction or ideally all of our attraction aside and work outside of attraction in that space of experimentation and exploration and clunkiness and stopping and starting and trying different things and not being invested in it working or even feeling good. We're just invested in being curious and having a go. And that can be hard to do with someone you're having a romantic or sexual relationship with. Much easier to do with a practitioner who has a really clear code of practice and a code of ethics and is not there to play out your attraction to them or their attraction to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really cool. Yeah. To have that. I liked what you said about practice and concerto. It sort of reminds me when I do piano lessons as a kid and I would have to do these scales, you know, over and over and over again. And it's like, oh, this is so boring. Like, why do I have to do this? But then that forms the foundation of the song. And so it's very similar with the somatic sexology, where it's like you said, you know, doing these practices and building that, I guess, sexual foundation, building those skills, ingraining them as habits, and then being able to take that into the bedroom or into wherever. Yeah, I think that's really cool.
And the other thing I wanted to mention as well, which is an opportunity for people to come and practice, is that when COVID started, there's a group of practitioners, we started teaching what we call erotic embodiment classes. So they're classes where people come to do self-practice, but they're guided classes. So it's a bit like you go to an online yoga class and you have a teacher that guides you through some yoga process. We come in, and I always had a fantasy of being a yoga teacher. That's why I say it.
Nice.
So we come in and guide you through an erotic practice. We call them erotic embodiment practices. Some of them are more explicit than others. Most of them are not that explicit in a way, but they're all designed to work anywhere and everywhere. Meaning what we realized is when people went into lockdown, they were disconnected with other people. They weren't receiving touch. A lot of them were not having sexual connections. And everybody seemed to have forgotten that they can actually support themselves. They don't actually need someone else to give them touch. So we came up with like, oh, well, let's do these online classes. We know a lot of practices. Let's just run these classes twice a week. People can just drop in. It's for anybody and everybody. And people can do it. They could be in their bed completely naked, or they could be in their garage on a yoga mat with, like, you know, very little privacy, completely dressed, and it will work for everyone. There'll be a version of this that will work for every person. And they've been running since. We run them. There are two groups now. We have four classes a week. And we've got hundreds of people on our mailing list who are just really curious and really interested and drop in at different times. And we get to be really creative about what we teach. And quite sometimes esoteric, sometimes you know, very explorative. We just try a whole lot of different things. They're completely optional. So people come and we all say hello to each other. We don't stay on screen for the practices. Like, you can if you wanted to, but it's not about people watching each other. It's more about people being in a community but doing their solo practice on their own. And then we come back and have a little feedback afterwards and say and talk about what it was like for us. So if anybody's interested as well, there's information on the Institute's website. They're fabulous classes, and I wish the whole world got into them, because for me, I can't see a better solution to people's, to our sense of loneliness, to our sense of anxiety, to being able to connect better with our bodies, to bringing some eroticism into our lives. You know, there are lots of people who are also interested in that. And if you don't know anything, that's fine. You'll get lots of ideas from us.
That's awesome. It's like a yoga class, but erotic. I like it.
Yeah. We used to, it used to be called orgasmic yoga.
Okay.
That was the original name of it. That's Joseph Raymond coined the term orgasmic yoga, which we loved. But then the word orgasmic can be a little bit tricky for some people, because if you're not feeling particularly orgasmic, you think, oh, well, that's not the space for me. Or if orgasm is difficult, you think, oh, well, that's not for me. And some of the practices are pleasurable, but I wouldn't say they're orgasmic. And so we wanted to give it a wider kind of, and it's not yoga. It's not actually yoga. So we're not doing asanas, and we thought, okay, let's stop culturally appropriating this thing and call it something that it's, you know, has a bit more relevant. Yeah.
Nice. That sounds super cool. Yeah. I will be sure to link to everything in the description show notes. So
thank you.
People can find it all. But thank you. Yeah. So much for coming on the podcast. It's been a great chat. Very insightful. I've learned a lot. I think everyone will enjoy it. So
thank you so much for having me. I've been really excited to come on this podcast. I've listened to it and it's really, really great. And thanks so much for the invitation. And thank you for whoever's listening for putting up with my chatting.
It's great. Yeah. And that's a wrap. Thank you so much for listening to Sex, Money and Rage. If you haven't already, please hit the subscribe or follow button. Make sure notifications are ticked, and I will see you next time.